This episode of the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top available podcast app around. You can get instant updates of my new podcasts or others that you listen to directly to your app. It's free, easy to use, and gives you all the features you need to help discover new podcasts and even create your own. Whether you use an Android or iPhone device, this app is the podcast app for you. Get the Podbean podcast app now on Google Play or Apple's App Store and start enjoying more from the podcast that you love. Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, it's official. Jeremy Corbyn has been re-elected as leader of the Labour Party in what was arguably one of the worst kept secrets in British politics. But now he's convincingly won the Labour Party membership. Can he win the country? After his conference speech today, we'll be looking at how Labour might turn around some of the difficult polls they've faced in the last few months. But before we do, we'll be looking at events across the pond. As we'll all know, this week was the first presidential debate. Now, the pundits and the polls suggest that Hillary Clinton won convincingly. But does that mean she's going to get a boost in the polls? Or will the race remain as close as it seems to have been in the last few weeks? We'll be discussing that first of all. I'm joined today by Rob Vance from Penn Show in Berland and Leo Barassi from Noise of the Crowd. Gents, welcome back.
Hi, Kieran. Lovely to be here.
So, Rob, I think your topic this week is going to be looking at the debate on Monday and some of the reaction to that in the US. I mean, what was your impressions on some of the things we've seen and maybe some of the data that's come out of it?
Yeah, so I think fairly convincing polling, you know, post-debate polling showing that Hillary Clinton was felt to have won the debate amongst those who saw the debate. I think historical evidence suggests that there's a pretty strong relationship between winning, being perceived to have won the debate and then getting a bit of a polling boost afterwards. The interesting question there is whether that polling boost sticks. The historical precedent most obviously being talked about by lots of people is Romney was felt to quite convincingly have won the first debate with Obama in 2012. But actually the 4 or 5 points that he got after that as a sort of bump, post-debate bump, withered away, as we know, by election day to leave Obama sort of to win. So I feel like, without wanting to sound too trite, it's a win for Hillary Clinton, but only time will tell whether that actually sticks.
I'm interested in some of the debate polling because from a methodological perspective, and this is a polling-related podcast, you know, it's sometimes quite challenging to understand how these polls are done and what they're saying. I mean, what are some of the issues that we should be looking out for?
Well, the problem that you have in debate polling is you either have a representative sample of those that watch the debate, which is almost necessarily an unrepresentative sample of the electorate as a whole, or the other way around. So you have to kind of make a judgment about which of those is more important. And historically, people have tended to go for the view that you go for a more representative version of who watched the debate. So, for instance, in the CNN poll, I think I'm right in saying that the sample leaned 15 plus 15 Democratic leaning, which is nowhere near where they will be on election day, but suggests that Democrats were more interested in watching the debate, which is sort of interesting in and of itself. But it also, you know, gives a little bit of a clue to the fact that a win amongst a slightly skewed Democratic sample shouldn't be read into, well, you know, come election day, people feel, you know, everybody who feels, you know, everybody's going to vote feels that Hillary Clinton won the debate. Because the way this works, of course, is that then the media narrative is Hillary won the debate. So if you now go to a representative sample of the electorate, I think there's a decent chance, having got that kind of overnight lead in both the polling and in the pundits, that you then will have a more representative thing. But it's, you know, Trump is on reasonable ground saying that, you know, the polls are skewed Democratic because they kind of are, because that's who watched the debate. In and of itself, that's not bad for Hillary. Mm. The fact that her supporters, Democratic leaners, were engaged and wanted to watch the debate and felt that she did well is good because, you know, she needs to turn out her base as much as Trump does.
It could also be differential response rates, right? So it could be that actually it might not have been a plus 15 Democrat sample in terms of who watched it, but actually that's who wants to sort of take the poll. Just to put some numbers to this for people listening who maybe haven't seen these polls. So CNN did a poll recontacting people that said they were watching the debate. 62% said Clinton won, 27% said Trump won, but that was obviously this slightly, well, very skewed Democrat sample. A separate poll, which I believe from PPP, I believe tried to do it the other way you were talking about and look at the sort of more representative sample of voters, and that had it much closer, and Clinton on 51, Trump 40. So, but still, Clinton winning. I mean, Leah, I'll bring you in on some of this. I mean, there has been a poll recently, I think it's from Morning Consult, but I might be wrong, but shows Hillary Clinton having a sort of 3-point boost in the polls. So going from a point behind to, I think it's 3 points ahead overall. So even though she went up 3 points, it's kind of like a 2-point swing, I guess. Do you think that we should expect that to last?
Yeah, in a way, what matters more now is how the debate is talked about, perhaps rather than actually what happened in it. So, you know, the fact that the polls may or may not be representative of people who watched it, I think matters much less than the fact that the story now is that Clinton was ascendant in the debate. And I think that is significant because the story for the last 2 weeks or so had been that Hillary was on the back foot. We had the basket of deplorables, we had her pneumonia, and that Trump was dominating. So I think I would expect the debate itself, as you mentioned, the evidence seems to be, particularly with a lead this big, that you would expect a bump in the polls of a couple of points, something like 2 to 4 points. So this new poll seems in line with that. I would expect that in itself to unwind. That, you know, if it was just a debate and people just watched that and thought more positively of Clinton, I'd expect that to reverse after a little while. But I think actually it is quite significant that this has now changed the tone of the debate about the race. And I was sort of expecting that Clinton's numbers were going to be beginning to pick up again in the last couple of days before the debate anyway, because she'd stopped having the very worst headlines. And that hadn't happened. So I think this is going to be really interesting, because if her numbers now increase and stay increased over the next week or so, then I think that's showing that perhaps it's both the debate and a bit of a regression to the mean of where we were before.
What do we think about Trump's tactics during the debate? Because I thought he was kind of all over the place a little bit. I mean, Leo, I know you have a very specific point of view on this. We'll come to you in a moment. But, you know, he was kind of bombastic in some senses, but he then deliberately tried to make out he was holding back, particularly on, like, sort of Monica Lewinsky stuff, which he nodded towards but didn't actually bring up. I mean, what's he got to try and achieve in these debates? Because on the one hand, he has a certain appeal, but on the other hand, you know, how does someone like Donald Trump look presidential?
I thought it was strange tactics. I think in the run-up to it, there'd been a lot of coverage of the idea that lowering expectations, Trump's not going to be a great debater, Hillary's going to be very well prepared, trying to make it so that, you know, that in effect, all that Trump needed to do was show up, and therefore people would kind of call it as, oh, actually, he can debate a bit and do this, whereas I don't think he really did manage to achieve that. I think it was interesting that he essentially played to his base quite a lot and tried some fairly risky kind of off-the-cuff stuff about, oh, not paying taxes is smart, and there were various other bits and pieces which were kind
why
of...
Why not blame Clinton for everything?
Yeah, and sort of, you know, repeating various things which are at best sort of questionable in terms of their veracity. But I think that was odd, but I think he was kind of playing to his base. And maybe he feels that at this point in time, it's worth doubling down on the base, you know, not making a big thing of like, oh, Trump's kind of jettisoned all of his like slightly wackier out there views, but just like sort of go up, try and be himself and have the write up being, well, it didn't necessarily land. And then he's still got two other debates, and maybe with the town hall, he can, you know, do things. Or, but then it's interesting this week, a lot of spin coming out about advisors saying that he just doesn't take any advice and that, you know, let Trump be Trump and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, might all be kind of good kind of mood music around it, but none of it's really doing what I think everybody thinks he would need to do, which is appealing to some moderate voters and appearing to, you know, well, try it again, presidential. And I don't think he managed to do either of those things.
Yeah, although Trump seems to break every political rule book under the sun, doesn't he? I mean, let's look ahead briefly before we move on to events here at what happens next in the race. I mean, Leo, I'll come back to you. I'm still a bit nervous, I'll be honest, as someone who, you know, I mean, we all kind of want Clinton to win. I looked at an electoral college map the other day and sort of plugged in what I thought felt reasonable, at least at the time, and ended up with Colorado basically being the decider. And I just wonder whether, you know, even though there is this boost in the polls for Hillary, you know, Trump still has a large... The Republicans do seem to be sort of uniting behind him. I was talking earlier about his tactics. I mean, you noticed something in the focus groups in the debate that you thought was an area where he could really capitalise, didn't you?
So I watched the debate without following it on social media, without any other commentary, just so I could try and get the most unvarnished opinion of it myself, rather than sort of seeing what other people were thinking. And I really thought that Trump dominated the first third of the debate. When the topic was jobs and the international loss of jobs, I felt like he was saying things that were resonating in a way that Clinton wasn't. And this seemed to be backed up by the focus groups. So it's not a huge amount of evidence for it, but it seems like independents who watched the debate. Actually, this has now been lost in the sort of post-debate wash-up because there was so much else that happened later on. But actually, the first third seemed to be where they were preferring Trump to Clinton. And I think what was going on is Trump was very much feeling the pain. He was talking about problems, about jobs that were being lost, and he had some grand vision of going to create all these beautiful jobs and it's going to be amazing. And, you know, he didn't get into details. Clinton clearly had the details, but what she didn't have was the empathy. So she didn't talk about the problems. She didn't start by saying, look, there's a lot done. Obama has done all these great things and job numbers are up, but we've still got a massive problems in so many of our towns and cities, and here's how I'm going to fix them. Mm. She just jumped straight to here's how I'm going to fix them. And I think that really didn't work. And I think she was clearly going for looking presidential by being on top of the detail. But I think, the focus groups back this up, that Trump seems to have an opportunity here. Now, post-debate, he hasn't picked up on this at all, which is just about Trump being Trump, perhaps, is what his advisors want to focus on. But it feels like there's this space now to really push on the kind of blue-collar, post-industrial sort of I'm the man who understands your pain and speaks for you, which I think is a gap that Clinton has still left open for him.
Sure, we've got a couple more debates in October. Before we move on, I do want to move on quickly, but Rob, I was talking about the Electoral College earlier. If we assume that Hillary's probably got the balance of that on her side still, she's probably about. I mean, what are the states that you're keeping a real keen eye on that maybe if they were to start going Trump's way, you'd be really concerned she might not pull this off?
So you're right to identify Colorado. I think at the moment on most sort of projections, it's the one that currently is in Hillary's column, but is only just in Hillary's column. And so further movements towards Trump in Colorado would be very problematic. There's two ways of looking at it. I mean, I think Leo mentioned earlier mean revision. There's one way of looking at it, which is this is like a high watermark for Trump, and that actually, with a bit of mean revision, it goes the other way, and actually states that are currently in Trump's column on most projections, so Florida would be one, actually that the thing to look out for there is whether that moves back towards Hillary. But I think in the other direction, and North Carolina, so Florida and North Carolina currently in the Trump column, but I think could be, you know, states for Hillary and were states obviously for Obama in 2008, though North Carolina Romney took in 2012. The other way, the place where Hillary should be getting more worried would be Pennsylvania, I think, which is currently in the Democratic, is currently in her column along with Colorado, but I think Pennsylvania has large chunks which are very like, well, Ohio, which is currently in Trump's column. So if you're looking at the kind of the map, Obama's 2012 map versus now, the differences are, you know, losing Florida, losing Ohio. If we lose Colorado and Pennsylvania, then, you know, you're in real
certainly going to keep an eye on those polls in the coming weeks. Let's move on to events sort of closer to home. Obviously, Jeremy Corbyn convincingly re-elected as leader of the Labour Party. Much debate now on where Labour goes from here. Before we talk about the future, Leo, you were looking at this exit poll that I think Ian Warren from Election Data conducted with YouGov at some of the numbers around what was behind the result and maybe, you know, what we look for in the future.
That's right. So, so Corbyn, overall, a slight increase in his majority, 62% on 60% last time. Where I think it's really significant is his numbers among members have increased quite well. So from 50% last time to 60% this time. That's partly driven by people who voted Burnham switching to him now. But actually, the thing that's really going on is this is about a change in the membership. So he very convincingly won among new members. And in fact, Smith won 63% of old members. So this is very much a different party, and it's a split party between old members and new members. I think there are two reasons now that things are going to be even tougher for his opponents who want to get rid of him in terms of internal party dynamics. So the first is Corbyn won 70% of registered supporters. Now, these people who paid £25 to vote, so they're clearly pretty keen, and you've got to assume that momentum is going to be pushing for them to become full members of the party, and assuming that there isn't another leadership vote in 6 months, then we've got to expect that a lot of these people are going to be full members by the time of the next leadership election. So we've got to assume that the members will be more pro-Corbyn, particularly that coupled with the fact that a lot of the people who are anti-Corbyn, the older members, are going to leave now. And then just the other issue is about a year ago, a quarter of people who had voted Corbyn in the previous leadership election were clearly having doubts about him. They were saying that they would prefer a leader who can get Labour into power than one who was absolutely on board with their principles. And it sort of seemed to me at the time that Corbyn was just about beatable. If you could make an argument to those people, it was close, but it seemed doable. I think those people have stuck with Corbyn now, and this is going to be a big psychological thing, that they've made a decision to stick to vote for him again, and that's going to bind them to him and going to make it even harder for the opponents to win them over. So not only is the membership bringing in more people who are pro-Corbyn, but the ones who are having doubts are now, because there's been this challenge, because they voted for him again, are going to be even firmer in their support for him. So it all feels like it's very hard to see how he can be beaten before he loses a general election.
I don't think he can be. I think that there's a lot of talk from some people about how Owen Smith wasn't the right candidate. It's almost post-rationalising the fact that he was somehow ran a bad campaign or was a bad candidate. And clearly there were mistakes that Owen Smith made in some of the relatively consistent, relatively misogynist comments that came out of his mouth. But also, you know, trying to just be, I'm a bit of a nicer version of Corbyn. But it's easy to post-rationalise it at the same time. I just wonder whether, when you've got like hundreds, you know, thousands and thousands of people joining to back Jeremy, I think it's just, I mean, people use the phrase cult. I think that's probably loaded, right? We see some of that. Well, we've seen some of that on social media, but actually, look, let's not call everyone that. But ultimately, I think that there's a principle now that that the membership wants to back Jeremy, and that is what it is, and we have, you know, it has to be ridden out. I mean, Rob, what do you think that the so-called moderates or Corbyn sceptics within the PLP do now? Because there's a lot of talk about sort of unity and getting on with it and sort of accepting the result, but that's can manifest itself in a number of different ways, right?
Yeah, so there's a few things. I think one is that I think it was very hard for Owen Smith, who the public hadn't heard of until he announced that he was going to be candidate to lead the Labour Party. Very hard, given his argument was essentially, I'm no different on policy, I'm just more electable. Very hard to make that argument to both the membership and the country when nobody's really heard of him. So on what basis is he more electable? So I think that's very hard. So I think there's an instruction there, which is that any candidate who wants to challenge Corbyn in the future needs to, in a sense, put in more groundwork to make that argument. I think there were a lot of people, some of whom actually didn't vote for Corbyn last time round, who actually were persuaded by sort of two things. One is, well, they're all saying that this guy needs to be electable, and I don't really see it myself. And the other one being, well, he's only had a year, we should probably give him a bit longer than that in order to make a go. I'm not convinced that at the moment it's Jeremy Corbyn's problem, it could be that the party is disunified and so on. So I think first thing is, like, any person that wants to challenge Corbyn in the future needs to lay a lot of groundwork about making themselves more appealing and more electable to whoever that might be, whether it's, you know, former Tory voters in the West Midlands, whether it's you know, the commentariat who write up glowing profiles of them, whoever it might be, you need to have some kind of constituency. Owen Smith didn't really have a constituency, I think it's fair to say, in any kind of area. He was just anyone but Corbyn, and that wasn't sufficient to win over the membership. Second thing that's interesting is, I think, in that Leo talks about these sort of young new members, but I think, well, there's a stat up there which is, you know, actually 18 to 24s were backing Smith, which is interesting. So a lot of young people joining the party, presumably some of them to not vote for Corbyn but to vote for Smith. And that, I think, could be instructive in terms of who the activists are likely to be and so on. It also instructive about who it is that was joining to vote for Corbyn, who I think there's some anecdotal evidence, at least, that they are not, as it were, new members, but they are former members who...
Pre-Blair members.
Well, maybe pre-Blair, or maybe, you know, pre-2002, you know, got fed up, whatever, you know, or possibly Iraq war, whatever, you know. There are various sort of hypotheses about who they might be, but also about what those members actually do to the day-to-day running of the party. There's a fair amount of evidence that suggests that they are not going and doing much in the way of canvassing, that they're not that they are going to some kinds of meetings but not to others, and obviously that has a big impact on the way the party's run. And then the final point in actually addressing your question, which is what you do in Parliament, and I think we've seen some of the seeds of this already, which is there are things like select committees and various other places where I think there is an opportunity for people who actually, on the face of it, don't really necessarily disagree very much on policy, with a few possible exceptions, but actually Corbyn's speech today kind of, and the conference this week has kind of brushed those away in terms of Trident, it's kind of, he's recognised that the unions are never going to support getting rid of it, so it's kind of like, well, why make this a totemic thing? He said that he would never use it if he was Prime Minister, so therefore, like, he's kind of done his bit in completely ruining the case for mutually assured destruction, etc. You know, but there are very little policy difference, actual real hardcore policy differences. This is about mood music, this is about the way in which the language that we use as a party, I'm sort of now speaking as a Labour Party member, to talk about politics and to talk about policy, where there might be differences, and there's a valence, there's a competence issue. And I think on all of those fronts, there is the opportunity for people of, you know, substance and standing to be able to make a Labour case for a Labour vote at the next election on the basis of holding the government to account in select committees, of doing things in the House, of running campaigns that are effectively delivering things, on running cities like London, Manchester, Liverpool and Birmingham effectively and running good campaigns for those things, where they don't need to be at the leader's teeth, and it's going, there are probably going to be some conflicts and so on, but it doesn't need to be the sort of open warfare that we saw in the post-referendum period. You know, I think it's possible to have unity in over, you know, the broad direction of policy. The NEC is now kind of not necessarily, well, certainly isn't as pro-Corbyn as I think most people thought it was in that, you know, in July. And so, you know, I think there are sort of strands which moderates should be seizing, and any talk of breakaway parties and so on has basically died this week. Yeah. The Commentariat want it because it would be a really great, fantastic story for them to write, but there's no appetite amongst either the leaders or the members who were anti-Corbyn.
Come back to policy in a minute, but I think that there are potentially more divisions than we realise if we look at free movement, for example. There are sort of signs of some
divisions within the pro-Corbyn bloc, if you like.
Like Rachel Reeves, Andy Burnham, insofar as you take what he says this week seriously, you know, talking about immigration, and you know, I think Corbyn having a very strong free movement message. So that will be interesting to see how that develops.
Which ironically is the position of most of the sort of Blairites in exile, actually. You know,
so it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I want to look at some, for my topic, some of the national numbers. I mean, one of the things that we know, if we look at the polling amongst the general public or amongst voters, is that you know, Labour's position isn't very good. I mean, we know that already. I don't want to dwell on that too much. But there was a sort of timely ICM poll over the weekend which looked at voting intention. The Conservatives 15 points ahead. Not a lot of change. I think Labour had dropped 2 points to 26. The Tories were unchanged on 41, UKIP 14, Liberal Democrats 8. And, you know, in all the sort of hubbub that's going on, there seems to be a relatively settled view at the moment in terms of what the political makeup of voters is. And I suppose there is a separate point that we almost ignore when we look at Labour's plight, which is that as long as the Tories are picking up 40-odd percent of the vote, very difficult to see where Labour goes from there. If we look at some of the other numbers, this was from Comres. So they gave sort of two scenarios and you had to choose which one you agreed with most, or you could say you didn't know. Labour can win an election with Jeremy Corbyn. That's a paraphrased version of what they said, but 16% chose that statement, whereas 65% said the Conservatives would win under Theresa May. One in five don't know. Corbyn is the right person to unite the country post-Brexit, 19% versus 56% for Theresa May. Now, we already know that Theresa May has pretty strong personal poll ratings for a new Prime Minister. Maybe it's the honeymoon, maybe it isn't, maybe it's something else. But you know, these are the numbers in which Labour have got to work with. Also, Labour is more divided than I can ever remember, unsurprisingly. 74%.
Some people clearly don't remember the other periods in the party's history very well or weren't born, but
well,
yes.
Well, quite. You know, 74% agree, 10% disagree. And I, perhaps the most worrying thing, I think, for Labour, I understand what Labour stands for, agree 45, disagree 36. So there's a lot of confusion going on, lots of division. Theresa May seems doing a reasonably good job. And that all kind of sort of translates into strong VI numbers. I mean, Leo, I kind of want to start looking, we know the polling position is bad, but let's start looking towards the future a bit. I mean, what can Labour actually do to try and sort of turn this around?
I mean, just one thing to add on the gloom before we look at the future is the numbers are actually even worse than you're suggesting, because all of those are polls among all of the general public, not specifically those who vote. So, for example, on the right person to lead the country, among 65 plus people who are over 65, May is 80 to Corbyn 7. So his numbers are probably even worse amongst the actual electorate. What can Labour do? So, I mean, there's a bunch of policies that they have started to announce today. A few of them are potentially popular. Lots of them, I think, are challenging. But the single big challenge that they have, which you've alluded to there, is at the moment, I, and as a politics watcher, I would expect this to be relatively easier for me, would really struggle to complete the sentence. Labour thinks that the government is, or if Labour was going into government, it would. I mean, what is Labour's critique of the government? What is it that it would do? Well, but I mean, is it competence? Is it that they are just like Cameron? Is it that they pretend to be progressive, but they're not really? Is it that they're really right-wing?
Is it that they assume everyone else holds?
Well, sure. And I think that's absolutely right, but I think that has to change. That, you know, if you think about oppositions that have come into government, you know, you think back to 2010, and it's easy to think of the line, Labour crashed the car, or Labour didn't fix the roof when the sun was shining. You go back to 97, you can think about so easily about modernisation, and the Tories were incompetent and corrupt and weak. How is Labour framing the government now? What's the 2, 3, 4-word argument for what's wrong with the government and why Labour are different? The policies can follow that, but... You know, what's the central argument here? And at the moment, even with a speech today that's been actually quite well received, I don't think I'm any clearer about why Labour think the government is wrong and why they think they would be better.
There are some more numbers in this ICM poll which I thought were quite interesting. I won't read them all out, but I think I'll read some of the key findings. One of the ones that stuck out very much for me was this agree-disagree question. Jeremy Corbyn does not pay enough attention to the issues that are important to me and my family. Agree 43, disagree 24. So there is a sort of connection thing there, which I think is quite important.
But I think, so I think that is absolutely key. I think there are...
Labour are normally the party of fairness and, you know...
Yeah, and people think they care about ordinary people and stuff,
sure.
Normally, right?
No. And I think that's one of the easiest things for Corbyn to actually fix, because I think the perception is that he's not necessarily wrong. It's about... some things, you know, in terms of what the country as a whole, or certainly swing voters and as a whole want. I mean, I think some of the stuff about, you know, fairness and opportunity and being against grammar schools and being pro-nationalisation of the railways and so on, those are popular policy positions amongst the kinds of people that Labour does need to win back, or at least appeal to, and also turn out come an election in the future. But it's about priorities, and I think that idea that Jeremy Corbyn cares more about, for the sake of argument, certain foreign policy concerns, or Trident, or some more, as it were, sectarian issues in terms of within the Labour Party or the Labour family, of, you know, issues that are more important to activists than to the country as a whole, that's actually a relatively easy thing to fix, right? And actually, from the point of view of party unity, a relatively easy thing to fix, because what, you know, the opportunity there for the moderates or whoever to come out doing is to actually make the case that there are Labour people standing for Parliament who do care about those issues and who do make those things more important and do matter to them, and that they are, in a sense, in the right place on those issues. That doesn't necessarily mean that in terms of policy there's a big difference, but it's the priority given to those things and the campaigns that are given there. Where, you know, and so if Corbyn wants to be Corbyn and campaign on the things that he's campaigned on his entire life, which by his own confession are often minority pursuits, that's kind of fine that we don't have necessarily a disagreement about that. Because I think the biggest thing there in terms of the numbers is that it says, you know, can unify the country, whatever. I mean, at the moment, the British public would look at that and go, well, if you can't even unify his party, how on earth are you going to unify the country? Which is a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
It also feels you're being a bit glib on, like, he's got the things that he wants to campaign on, because a lot of the things he wants to campaign on are things that sink Labour below the waterline. I mean, you know, he's been talking about wanting to relax immigration. Well, it's great that he really stands up for what he believes, and, you know, he is clearly anti-MOD, he's anti-Trident, he's anti getting involved in other countries' affairs, even if, you know, collective defence and so on. You know, he can stick to his values, but a lot of those values are things that the Tories will be rubbing their hands on.
I think he's in a minority in some of those views, even within his shadow cabinet. You know,
sure.
I think Emily Thornberry and Clive Lewis, both of which, actually, you know, they might well, to an extent, agree with him on Trident, but, you know, you can clearly see that they're carving out, as it were, a new left, non-Corbyn foreign policy agenda, which is probably closer to the centre of gravity of at least the Labour Party, if not the country as a whole.
But there is a challenge here, because one of the reasons I think Jeremy Corbyn, other than changing the electorate that he won among in terms of the Labour membership, I mean, one of the reasons that you hear a lot of Labour members say that they voted for him is that he stands for things, he doesn't just want to win for the sake of it, he has sort of principles, and Leo, you alluded to that. I was looking at this ICM poll at some of the... It put some policy areas to people and said, what should Jeremy Corbyn do and shouldn't do? won't read the specific numbers out, but basically it shows that people disagree with Jeremy Corbyn on scrapping Trident, disagree with him on letting more Syrian refugees in, they disagree with scrapping the sort of benefits cap. They do agree with the renationalisation of the railways. So I suppose that there is an argument, as you were saying, Rob, to sort of put the areas where there is agreement with the public front and centre. But, I mean, ultimately, though, Leo, like, Labour aren't just going to jettison all these ideas, and nor necessarily should they. So they've got a real problem in terms of deciding and prioritising where they do actually take the public on and where they don't.
So I think the railways is a great example. I think it is a policy that polls have found to be popular for quite a long time, but no one has really put the opposing case very strongly politically to it. And I would bet that if right now Labour made it a central policy and the Tories attacked them on it for being profligate, for just wanting to nationalise everything, just going back to bad old Labour, they would be absolutely stuffed on it. I don't think it's impossible. I think you can fix that, but I think first you've got to have changed the perceptions of the party. First, you've got to be credible that you're going to be reasonable with your spending and you know how to manage things, and you're not just throwing out a load of sort of wishful thinking policies, that you've really thought it through first before you can offer this kind of stuff that's quite easy to attack.
Because I always wonder with the nationalisation of the railways point, that really what that poll says is that people want the railways to change. And yeah, because they don't like the current service. Whereas whether it's public ownership of it, I'm not sure that's the bit they're committed to. I think it's possibly just change.
But it's kicking big companies as well, right? I mean, there's probably better ways to kick unpopular companies than picking a fight with the railways. I mean, you know, Ed Miliband was very good at that, and that was probably one of his most popular things.
I mean, final few minutes, because I feel like when we looked at the last general election, there was this elephant in the room, which was that people frankly just preferred David Cameron as a prime minister to Ed Miliband. And, you know, there is very clearly a difference in terms of how people perceive Theresa May as a credible Prime Minister versus Jeremy, who they don't. How do you challenge that? I mean, can you, Rob? I mean, there is this narrative that actually leaders are defined very early, and once you're defined, there's nothing you can really do. So, I mean, is Jeremy Corbyn flogging a dead horse at convincing the British public that he can actually be a credible Prime Minister in waiting? He seems to be talking a lot more about winning this week. I've noticed that.
The opening of his speech was a re-articulation of Clause 1 of the Labour Party Constitution, which has been the sort of slightly snidey sort of criticism that the moderates in the party have kind of had, which is that, you know, they're Clause 1 socialists rather than Clause 4 socialists or whatever. Now, I think that's interesting, because I think that is an important, in a sense, that is what he would consider to be his olive branch to the moderates, which is, I do actually care about winning elections, it's not just about being right. So I think that's interesting in and of itself. If that is the case, his power or his, you know, control over the party and him and his, you know, supporters' control over the party is in a sense more secure, then maybe there is a greater opportunity for him to pivot towards a kind of, if you like, a more kind of election footing, an election that faces the country rather than his opponents within the party. So that's one thing that could help. A more unified party, if the moderates kind of say, look, well, there's nothing that we can do. He's going to be our candidate at the next election. We're going to have to put on grin and bear it, put on a brave face, make sure that, you know, the moderates and the leading moderates within the party keep their seats, that we resist too much in the way of deselections and so on, and make sure that we run a really good swing seats campaign at the next election to try and, as it were, limit the damage. Then that's like, you know, the moderates stop sniping in the media and get on with that kind of, that's the battle then. Mm. Keeping moderates in parliament becomes a battle rather than toppling Corbyn. Then that might mean that Corbyn can do a bit of a pivot, and this would be with the media as much as with the country, which is, look, I'm an authentic, no-nonsense person. I'm not malevolent and malicious and nasty. I don't want to do all these sort of horrible things that I'm accused of doing. I don't necessarily want to make X, Y, and Z a priority, though I still passionately believe them, and it would be wrong of me not to do that. And then he kind of could build up some kind of credibility of holding to the government to account on the things where I think he's probably right. The government are, you know, in danger of being out of touch, unpopular, pandering to a particular kind of, you know, business, you know, very sort of business or wealthy or affluent, whatever agenda. You know, and I think there is an extent to which he can do that effectively.
That's priced into Tory government, isn't it? Don't Tory governments lose when they're incompetent? People assume that they're nasty.
But then that's what you have to do every day. You have to, you know, you have to work on the basis that they're, that not only are they not on, as it were, the side of the British people, but also they're not effective at delivering that. And I think at the last election, it was quite clear that whilst people didn't necessarily agree with the thrust of what Osborne and Cameron et al. Were doing, that they were reasonably competent at doing it.
Yes.
There is still definitely time, given the complexity of the Brexit negotiations and the way in which May's cabinet is kind of stitched together in such a way that it's actually quite precarious. Labour disunity has kind of not led there to be a huge amount of light shone on that. And next week's Conservative Party conference, I'm sure, will be a fantastic jamboree of unity and, you know, all hail to the chief kind of stuff. Because, you know, the Tories are much better at sucking it up and grinning and bearing it. William Hague's piece in The Telegraph today was quite clear about that. You know, they bide their time, and then when the time has come, they're lethal.
Yeah.
So, you know, that, but as Leo says, it's competence that they need to attack the Conservatives on rather than being unfair. But obviously doing it, the ideal thing is to do it when you've got the kind of the overlapping thing of, you know, they're both unvirtuous and incompetent.
Yes. I mean, Leo, final word to you, because, I mean, Rob raises a good point, doesn't he, that, you know, Theresa May be seen as a much more credible Prime Minister than Jeremy Corbyn, but in this crazy world in which we live, there's no guarantee that it will be Theresa May at the next general election, is there? I mean, one assumes that it would be, but you look at the Brexit negotiations, if they don't go the way that some of the Brexiteers want them to, unless you just sort of caves into them.
But what do they want? I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. Johnson, Fox, yeah, and Davis. I mean, the idea that three of those are going to display unity for the next 4 years.
But even if she just basically does what she seems to have done so far and says, I'm just going to back that wing of the party so they don't create problems, surely that opens space for, say, a former Chancellor to sort of try and carve out a role.
I really don't see it. I think the Tories know that they're onto a good thing with May. I mean, I think the Corbyn question is really interesting and different from Miliband. I think Miliband's flaws in the eyes of the public were quite fundamental and quite character-based. So his backstory was just not appealing. He was a backroom nerd. He was a geek. He looked a bit weird. He knifed his brother. Actually, though, clearly Corbyn's personal ratings at the moment are terrible, I'm not sure they're so integral to who he is. I think his backstory is potentially better. And, you know, you could present him as a sort of, you know, thoughtful, experienced older man who's actually sort of, you know, knows what he's talking about. And, you know, you could see him looking the part potentially. I think the flaws are the behaviour stuff. And I'm not sure that the public necessarily have really got the, like, yeah, so fundamentally thinking he's someone who's never changed his mind about anything, he's an old hard lefty, because those are actually kind of policy things. And look, I'm putting on an optimistic front on this, and I know his numbers are absolutely dreadful, but those sort of feel more changeable. I mean, if you had Miliband, you can't stop looking like you look like. You can't undo the fact you knifed your brother and that was the first that people had heard of you. Corbyn, you can, if you really want to, change the fact that you're seen as an old lefty who hasn't changed his mind about anything.
Do up your tie and sing the national anthem. I don't think that's going to go well.
I think what's instructive is the last successful hard left politician in the UK was Ken Livingstone, who won, let's remember, 2 elections in London.
In London?
In London, and then did obviously lose to Boris. But the way in which he won those things is he didn't stop believing in the things that he believed in, really, but the way that he governed and the way that he managed himself and the way that he managed campaign was as actually quite technocratic and quite competent. He was like a cheeky Londoner who actually was quite covertly able to sort of curry favour, or at least manage the city's expansion, knowing that the city paid for stuff that London needed, and that, you know, whilst that was going well, that sort of bought him political space. And Londoners felt that with the congestion charge and various other things, he was kind of like, broadly, he was like on their side and competent at running the city. If Corbyn can like take a bit of a leaf out of that episode in Ken Livingstone's career, to be very clear, of like how you as a how you can as an ideological lefty actually run something reasonably competently, yeah, then I think that, and it's interesting with people like Fisher and various other former Livingstone City Hall types closer to him, I think listening to those people more and the Seamus Milnes of this world less would set him in good stead to be able to take on May more effectively.
Well, time will tell. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn's ever been in as much a position of strength as he is now. Gents, thanks very much for your time today. That's all we've got time for this week's politicalbetting.com polling matters show. Certainly lots to keep an eye out for in the near future, not least events across the pond where Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump still seem locked in a knife-edge race for the White House. We'll be looking at that next week, and also the Conservative Party conference as Theresa May gives her first keynote speech to the party faithful as Prime Minister. You've been listening to the politicalbetting.com polling matters podcast, which is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top podcast app around. You can get instant updates of your new favorite podcasts directly to your Podbean podcast app.
It's free, easy to use, and lets you easily discover new podcasts that you love and also publish your own podcast too. Whether you use an Android device or an iPhone device, this app is the app for you. So get the new Podbean podcast app today on Google Play or Apple App Store. Enjoy more from the podcasts that you love.